There's an episode of Community called Remedial Chaos Theory. The story concerns a housewarming party. A pizza guy buzzes the apartment.
Annie, it's just the pizza.
We can't buzz him up.
All the guests put their fingers to their noses. Nobody wants to go down and pick up the pizza.
Someone has to go down.
The gang is playing a game of Yahtzee, so Jeff comes up with this idea.
Starting on my left with one, your number comes up, you go.
Just so you know, Jeff, you are now creating six different timelines.
Of course I am, Abed.
Now, this sounds like a fairly typical premise for a situation comedy, but something happens that transforms this into one of the greatest episodes of TV comedy ever made. Remedial Chaos Theory, this wonderful episode of Community, actually follows six different timelines. And seeing different choices in different timelines made by characters we've come to appreciate over three seasons allows us to know their inner thoughts and feelings better than any conventional narrative. My name is Edward Champion, and this is The Bat Segundo Show. We all understand the need for resolution in life and in narrative, but when we stick to our conclusive guns, what do we give up in knowing other people? Catherine Davis has dared to answer these questions in her provocative new novel, Duplex. Now, this is a book that inhabits a fantastical universe of duplexes. There are areas in this book that are settled by robots, and dogs, and sorcerers, and rabbits. And the fluidity of Davis's universe allows revelatory possibilities, ways of looking at life that are quite possibly impossible using the traditional methods. I met with Catherine Davis in Central Park to discuss everything from Leibniz's notion of the multiverse, Antonioni's movies, the intersection of religion and technology, and how stories provide us with essential tools to take in life. I mean, who needs the fallow attended by self-serving, venal, anti-intellectual hucksters like Malcolm Gladwell when you have great novels like Catherine Davis's Duplex? Okay, so I am here with Catherine Davis, who is most recently the author of Duplex. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. It's nice to meet you.
Yes, nice to... We're talking right here in the park.
It's beautiful.
A dog in a stroller has just passed by. We'll get into dogs in just a little bit.
Yes.
But I wanted to open this up with sort of a kind of complicated question. This morning, I was reading this piece on Aeon Magazine by Andrew Crumey about how much of contemporary art is still wrestling with Leibniz's ideas about the multiverse. Now, Leibniz claimed that all possible worlds exist in the mind of God, and that he ultimately chooses one universe made consistent by a principle of harmony. And of course, I was reading this and thinking, oh, well, this is absolutely what Catherine's doing with her book. God is usually benevolent, but he wouldn't make us believe in the reality of a false world, according to Leibniz. But your novel, Duplex, seems to be resisting this idea to some extent, because you're almost asking us to believe in a world that is almost post-reality. So I'm wondering, you know, just to start off here, to what degree did Leibniz and the spirit of the multiverse inform the writing of this book? Just a minor question.
I would say that there was nothing so specific as something I read that informed the universe of the book, but that the universe of the book is, in fact, the universe I dwell in.
Yeah.
So that in a way, I feel like Duplex is as much a work of realism as Look Homeward, Angel. I don't know why that occurred to me, but...
especially since he writes very fat books, Thomas Wolfe.
That's right, right, and I did want this to
be a
thin
Are you claiming
book.
To be Eugene Gant in any way?
No, okay. No, not a bit. But I do feel like it's my experience of the world that I was trying to replicate in the book. Now, I at one time read an enormous amount of cosmology, got very interested in that without being at all... trained as a scientist,
yeah.
So I got interested in the way that non-scientists do, taking a more metaphoric...
quantum mechanics is lay reading, basically.
Yes. And that is true also of topology, which I'm attracted to without understanding anything about it, really.
Yeah.
And yet, the idea that there are ways to think about the world we live in that that stretch the logical mind into a shape that doesn't resemble anything recognizable That is very appealing to me.
So what I'm getting at is you're drawing initially from your particular reality,
yes,
whether it be suburban or whether it be, you know, smaller city, and you're using much of this additional reading to create the kind of fantastic and phantasmagorical experience. And that this also, I'm wondering, aside from just how it subverts the experience, how language plays into this as well, because that's extremely curious, you know. So, you know, why do you think you're reading something along the lines of this gives it an edge? I mean, are you always resisting the prosaic or what here?
Well, I don't know that I resist the prosaic. In fact, writing this book, I felt like my experience growing up on a suburban street in Philadelphia, I really wanted to replicate that, which was a very, in its own way, prosaic experience. And yet, it was also clear to me that the prosaic had, if you unfolded it or untucked the edges of it, yes, there would be things much less prosaic going on, as, for example, a family of robots living on the street,
which is clearly drawn from reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I won't, you know, name the family, but there certainly was a family where the oddness of the family, as on any suburban street,
yeah,
I would say, anyone, ask anyone, and they will say, oh, yeah, there could have been a family of robots living on our street. There could have been a sorcerer who came and messed around with the souls of the young people.
Yeah.
That would be another way of describing, you know, a family that just didn't seem like all the other families.
Yeah.
Or,
so what you're basically doing is you're trying to, I suppose, avoid the prosaic or chronicle the prosaic by really tapping into all forms of perception. And as a result,
yes,
this is why this particular world in Duplex has no time, no space, has edges that are constantly shifting, has waves that are constantly intruding. To my mind, it seemed like you were challenging the reader to look at something typical and just anything. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that anything typical can become magical simply by just tilting it, even in any kind of direction.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And when I was a kid, the book that, I mean, my parents read to me, but
yeah,
the book that I loved the most, and that always seemed like the purest expression of the world I lived in, was Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
I could not get enough of it, and it really described to me the world I grew up in, the house I grew up in, the people I spent my time with. So in a way, I'm doing nothing different in this book than I feel like Lewis Carroll was doing in Alice.
Yeah. Well, I know Joy Press once said that you were the offspring of Virginia Woolf and Lewis Carroll.
Right.
So,
I loved that.
Yeah, yeah. Which has cropped up in a couple of interviews I've read. But I mean, you know, that does bring to mind. Would you say that you err more on the side of Carroll than Woolf, or what?
Oh, I'd like to think I'm in equal parts.
Yeah.
I feel like what I learned from reading Virginia Woolf, and again, it was the same kind of encounter with a book. In the case of Virginia Woolf, it was To the Lighthouse.
Yes.
And reading it, I couldn't believe that someone had written that book.
Yeah.
That just so perfectly talked about the way I experienced the world, which is what you really want, I think, a book to do, even if it takes you by surprise, even if it's talking about climbing Mount Everest or something which you've never done, but
yeah,
it tells you something that you sort of knew, but in a way that you didn't know you knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the language of Virginia Woolf and the psychological realm that she so amazingly dwells in and describes, that is every bit as important to me as the sort of perverse antic quality of Carroll's prose and the world he describes.
So I guess the grounding of consciousness of Virginia Woolf, or even the fluidity of consciousness seen in something like Orlando, which is a favorite of mine, is,
I love that,
yeah, too. I know, and can also almost be qualified as science fiction. I mean, this is
an
appeal.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you feel that fiction really doesn't, I mean, why do you think so much of fiction just puts a border there when we're talking about consciousness. Basically says, no, you actually have to go ahead and adhere to this idea that life must be crammed into the valise of narrative. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Yeah. I think it's a more boring approach to the world of possibility.
Yeah.
When you're writing. I certainly know that if I felt like I had to subscribe to a set of rules, if that's what you had to do in order to be a writer of fiction,
yeah,
I wouldn't have wanted to be a writer of fiction. I think my sense of not wanting to be a mathematician when I was much younger was because it just seemed like a whole bunch of rules. It turns out I was wrong about that. But the sense that you are being told you can only go this far and no further is of no interest to me.
Yeah. There was an essay in Book Forum, I believe in July, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was basically saying that the unfinished novel is of greater moral uplift than the finished novel. Because as you're writing a novel, this essay said, you're basically fighting against some kind of mortality. And that mortality is fresh and alive when it's unfinished. Would you say that, how do you contend with this notion? Because resolutions in your books are not always neat, nor are they actually clear-cut. And I'm wondering, do you feel, what are your thoughts on this idea of keeping that mortality alive in something that is both unfinished but, as it so happens, in your case, is also finished?
That's a great question. I'll say that one of the forms that really appeals to me is the murder mystery.
Yes, I know that.
And I love everything about a murder mystery, actually, except the ending.
Yes, because you have to have resolution. I when I found this out, like just doing research, I was going to ask you about that, because, I mean, how could you love a form so much? I mean, what do you take away from it as a reading experience when you have the cop explain everything or the criminal say, here was my plan all along? I mean, how do you wrestle with such a genre, which is, I love, by the way, and actually I do happen to like some of those explanations myself. What do you take away from it?
I would hate to read a murder mystery. I would hate to read a P.D. James,
yeah,
and not have a resolution. I would want to strangle her because the book is set up to give you that.
Yes.
But the form, the generative form, the form where something happens early on or something is said or there's some sense of a mystery that is established very early on in the book. And part of your pleasure and job as a reader is to track down what's happening.
Yeah.
That feeling is one of my favorite feelings in life. I love not, being given a piece of evidence or a clue. I mean, this all goes back, I'm sure, to the house I grew up in where nobody said anything outright and you were always having to try to figure out what was going on.
I see.
By reading between the lines or reading, the clues or...
So a constant life of mystery and a constant reading life of mystery.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for my own part, I actually thought, well, you love reading these murder mysteries. Why don't you just write one? I believe firmly you should write what you love to read. It turns out that if you want to write a murder mystery, you really have to figure out an awful lot of stuff ahead of time in a way that I am just not interested in doing. It would be boring to do that. And I've written some books that seem to me, that feel to me, to sort of make use of that genre. I felt like that was true of The Walking Tour, for example. But I didn't want there to be the detective calling everybody into the drawing room and telling everyone what happened.
You must be a big fan of the Antonioni film La Ventura, the missing girl is unexplained. It never actually is explained. And exactly, I mean, Antonioni to me would seem to be your match for literature, because there's so much rich life. And even in his most narrative film, The Passenger, even there, you don't actually have a clean-cut resolution. You have Jack Nicholson disappear, and you're still invited to witness this amazing display of life at the end of the picture. I guess the way to kind of continue this conversation is to ask, you know, why this is something to be resisted, why this is almost kind of a strange underground attitude or set of sensibilities to inhabit in 2013.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And I guess.
That was a little critic walking
right.
past. Yeah.
Sad at the idea of lack of conclusion.
Yeah.
I think it makes people very nervous.
Yeah.
I think life makes people nervous,
yeah.
And part of what makes people nervous about life is not knowing what lies ahead. Even though if you knew what lay ahead, the idea of actually knowing what's about to happen
yeah.
is so appalling to me that I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah.
But I also know that this is the human wish to feel sort of contained,
yeah.
and part of a logical system, one that isn't going to pull the rug out from under you. That's a very, very strong wish,
yeah.
And it's sort of it's probably some kind of a survival mechanism also.
It's not just a survival mechanism. It makes me think of the joke in the Peter Cook Dudley Moore movie, Bedazzled. There's one situation where Peter Cook is the devil. It's a marvelous movie.
I love that movie.
The remake is terrible, but this is a genius movie. And there's one part where Peter Cook is just picking up a pair of mysteries, and he's ripping out
the last page,
every single one. And the fact that that's actually condemned as sort of demonic or something that only the devil do, I think says much about our need for resolution, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I felt like the devil in that movie,
yeah.
in many ways, was doing exactly what you would
want to have done. Yeah.
And when he scratches the records.
Yes. And of course, the wonderful song, the terrible popular music song in that, which is hilarious.
Yes, but, it is, scratch that record.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, pull out those pages.
Yeah. But it's a rebellious act. It's an act of nihilism. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, remember, I mean, now that we're thinking about cinematic, it makes me think of like Jack Nicholson again as the Joker in Batman going into the museum and just throwing paint and destroying art. This used to actually be something that we contended with in mainstream pictures, mainstream books, mainstream art. And now it's fascinating to me that the nihilism has been, you know, now you have to go to a house like Grey Wolf in order to actually explore these questions. Why do you think that is?
I believe, boy, that's a big question, but I have an answer.
You do?
Yeah, I think that the timidity, the cultural timidity, has to do with the fact that the world is a frightening place. But is it more frightening now than it was, say, in 1960? No, I don't think so. In fact, the threat of nuclear annihilation was so present in everybody's mind.
But maybe it's out of sight, out of mind. There's an Eric Schlosser book coming out called Command and Control, which deals with how fragile the entire nuclear infrastructure is.
But nobody talks about it.
Nobody talks about this.
And
just as
fact,
people are accepting the NSA surveillance, people want to accept this kind of thing. Maybe they're beaten down. Maybe we're just putting on more blinders these days. Maybe we don't want to actually open up the floodgates to every single problem. And maybe this is what you say. It's about living life and accepting it and all of its hard knocks and all that, you know?
But it is really true, and it's I've thought a lot about this.
Yeah.
Because people don't want you to write books that don't end happily.
Yeah. Unlikable characters, which has become a big issue this year.
You're right.
Yeah.
Right. Movies should it is now the case that if you go to the movies,
yeah.
Especially with the movies made in this country.
Yeah, we have to go to television to actually get a gripping narrative.
And you're not ever going to see something where there's going to be an inconclusive or really, really unhappy ending.
Yeah.
Even so, I realize there's the suspense level is eradicated by the fact that even when, you know, somebody's, you know, clinging to the edge of a cliff,
yeah,
and you're thinking, oh my God, I hope he's going to survive.
Yeah.
You know he's going to, because they don't make movies where people drop off cliffs.
Yeah.
Not if he's the hero.
Yeah. So narrative, I guess, is doomed to go for the default heroic state. Yeah, yeah. Even from back in the 1930s Republic serials. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So I actually wanted to go back to your book. I mean, although this is all great. I mean, don't get me wrong. But
These are subjects I think about a lot.
So I've been thinking about them a lot, too. So we're both thinking and talking. Early on, the narrator of this book, who may or may not be this kind of Leibnizian god, he says the edge, or she says.
It's definitely a she.
Yeah, definitely a she.
Definitely, yeah.
The edge of the world is a real place where when you have no soul, there are no limits. Now, later in the book, Eddie announces, I sold my soul to the sorcerer, and this is what I got in return. We come to realize that even the most limitless realities do involve soul-searching in some sense. The seemingly soulless robots, I mean, they are wrestling with humanity in this in ways that the human characters can never possibly fathom. So you have fluidity of time, you have fluidity of space. It's so present in this novel, but I'm wondering to what degree is this novel responding to the commodification of the soul?
Well, that's an interesting question. Can you, commodification of the soul, just say a little bit more about that?
I mean, this is what I get in return, that line. That the idea that the soul is something to be easily capitulated with, possibly for a fantasy, possibly for some pleasant life, or the life of normality that, indeed, you were drawing from the very
right.
beginning.
The soul, one of the reasons I wrote this book, one of the reasons I write all my books is because I'm really interested in the question of the animating spirit.
Yeah.
What it is that makes us, you know, be living beings as opposed to a bench or a robot, say.
Yeah.
And I believe that whatever that is, it is not something that can be sold cheap. And that the effort to do that creates the most perverse things, certainly in the book, in Duplex. That was sort of my definition of the worst or evil.
Yeah.
Where the robots, who don't have souls, but who are themselves not trying to steal human souls, they're just a different kind of entity.
Yeah.
That's okay,
yeah,
because they're not part of the commodification system.
But at the same time, their essential essence is really buried in the book. Like maybe a little more than halfway through the book, you point out that the robots don't sleep. And when you start to realize and that hits you, you say, well, I now actually have to contend with this as a living and breathing element of identity. And, you know, it's a nice way also of castigating the unadventurous human spirit as well. And
yeah,
that's why I was sort of suggesting that, you know, is this idea of giving up one's soul, I mean, why is it an ultimatum here, do you think, in this book? Especially when there are very clear cues for both the reader and your human characters.
That it wouldn't be a good idea to do that.
Yeah.
Because there are things human beings want that might seem in the moment more valuable, you know, than having a soul.
Yeah.
It might seem better to be, you know, rich or successful, or a successful ball player, for example.
Yeah.
But any of, you know, fame and fortune might seem, and I do believe in this culture we live in, certainly have preempted the wish to, you know, live sort of a life in which the spirit
yeah.
dominates as opposed to the need to have more things.
Yeah. So what you're commenting upon, it seems, is the notion of, well, you can have it all. And
Right, and you can't.
You can't. You are always going to sacrifice something. You're always going to choose something. One choice may provide more life or less life than the other, more spirituality, more soul, or less spirit. And I guess maybe now that we're talking, I'm actually more inclined to just really support your book as a way of rethinking one's life, because
good.
I mean, because now you've got me thinking, well, yeah, you know, if that's what humanity has actually come to, that we need to completely warp the physical limits of our universe in order to actually understand this, we're in some serious shit.
I really agree.
Yeah.
I mean, that's I do believe that sense it certainly drove the writing of this book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think increasingly has driven me to write what I write.
Yeah.
As it seems to me, the circumstances of our life here on Earth become more and more grim and dire, and also that sense of there's, you know, no turning back.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody.
I wanted to approach this from a rather more compartmentalized, a more corpuscular standpoint. There are two words that are used most prominently. Robots, we've mentioned, but aquanauts is also mentioned. And I have to ask about this because the word aquanaut, most people don't realize this, but it actually preceded robot. 1881, it enters the English language. Robot, Carol Sapek, 1921. The robots and the aquanauts in this book seem to me two ways to be weirdly human, or maybe normally human, maybe spiritually human. Maybe it's weird because we aren't so spiritual. I'm wondering how you came to use these specific words in general, and given the timeless quality of your multiverse, well, you know, whether the age of these words ever factored in to their use in your book and their use in the sentence.
I didn't know what you just said about the word aquanaut predating robot, so that was not part of a plan.
Okay.
I knew sort of from very early on that there were going to be robots in the book. And I also knew that there were going to be these stories about our history that were going to involve things happening that I've thought a lot about. And one of the things I've actually thought a lot about, because I spent my summers at the New Jersey Shore a girl, was...
Before it became debased by MTV.
That's right. It was just a very sweet place to go for, you know, your summer vacation.
Yeah.
I used to really
a
think about...
A pre-New Jersey Shore.
Right.
Sorry.
Yes, no, that's true. I thought about, why did we always think it was better to be up here breathing air?
Yeah.
Where did that idea come from? And, you know, where was the idea that when, you know, those first amphibious creatures kind of crept out of the water and came to live on land, that was a good thing?
Yeah.
I mean, I was not opposed to the fact that I lived on land and breathed air, but I spent a lot of time in the water, and it always seemed to me that it would be equally desirable to live in the water. And now, of course, as it seems possible that the entire planet could be subsumed in water, it seems like this supposed myth from the past time of my book, the past history, also can be the future.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I was just having a discussion with someone today about the word monster and how I view the word monster in a sort of somewhat positive light. I mean, I think that, I mean, yes, there are bad monsters, but there are also good monsters. And this had my friend and I kind of going back to the etymology of monster. Interestingly enough, a monster is the same root, Latin-wise, of monitor, which I found interesting.
Really?
But here's what's fascinating about it. It started off as abnormal. Then there was this baleful cast to the word. And then now, in the last 50 years, especially with, like, more cuddly monsters in our culture, the monsters have become possibly good or bad. And yet, there's still this kind of old formalism that creeps up to the word, you know, he was a monster. Like,
right.
There could be no possible redemption. You just write someone off with that word. And that, to me, seems extraordinary because, and also very limited a very limited use of the word, because I feel the monster could be good as well. I mean, why does it always have to be bad? Why does aquanauts, or this notion of creatures coming from the sea, have to be a bad idea? No, it's something we're not used to.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it can't be bad. It's really a matter of conquering our fears in relation to the other or something like that, you know?
Well, that was definitely in my mind with the aquanauts.
Yeah.
Even more so, though. I mean, you're speaking about something...
Sorry for
I gave
rambling.
A lot of thought to, no, the character of Downey in the book was definitely a reflection of my thinking about what constitutes a monster. And though I never, he is never referred to as a monster, he is in a way he's the most monstrous that is... hard to describe, not looking the way a being is supposed to look, creature in the book.
Yeah.
And so that was, I had that in mind. Huh. And I always liked the monsters in the monster movies.
Yeah, yeah. I did too. You know, I mean, ultimately, I've always felt about monsters that if you just get to talking with them or get to understanding their nature, they're really operating off of fear. And actually, that's exactly the way the humans are as well.
Right.
Actually, while we're on this subject, you know, your robots here are quite fond of naming things. They call the dachshund ears pinyas. There's the column of the year. There are efforts to identify a merry bean and a bump. The way that Penny's and JCPenney is distinguished. The fish called Mr. and Mrs. Poopy. you know, it's almost as if there is both a kind of folly and an overlook invention here with some of these... names, these designates. Even as Janice fights against the impulse, why do you always want to hear names? Does that bush have a name? Does that tree? How about those fish? And so maybe a way of broadening this interest in the other or in monsters or whatnot, I have to ask, how early in the writing of Duplex, well, did you know that you were going to contend with this dilemma of applying finite nouns in a near infinite universe?
That evolved.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two sides to the answer to that question.
Of course, of being a duplex.
Right, that's right. I mean, on the one hand, no, it wasn't part of a plan.
Yeah.
On the other hand, because the tone of the book, in a way, owes quite a lot, I think, to the tone of the fairy tale, in which often you do not get highly specific nouns in particular. You will have a tree. You would never have, you know, a shadblow tree or something. I mean, it's always boiled down to the essence.
Very general, and, yeah.
So I knew that that was an important aspect of what I wanted the world of the book to be like, and I didn't want to have, you know, by and large, last names. I was trying to avoid that.
Yeah.
That turns out to be a crucial element in understanding the way the world itself operates. I didn't understand that until I was in the book, and actually when Janice said what she did, when I wrote what she said, I thought, of course, it's a part of the plan I had, but I didn't know it from the beginning.
Well, when did you really know that this was going to be a part of, you know, identifying the world? I especially when the world is clearly not meant to have these edges, except of course when they're explicitly named. Yeah, so it's a very tricky tightrope, so to speak.
It is. Yeah. I think I really knew quite a lot about the rules for the world when I wrote the first of the stories that Janice tells, The Reign of Beads.
Yes.
And in that I began to see, I mean, it was sort of up there with a creation myth, for example. It was a story talking about why the world is the way it is. And writing that helped me understand what things were and weren't possible in the world of the book.
Yeah. While we're on that, I actually wanted to ask you about the role of spirituality in this book. There's one point during the Four Horsewomen chapter in which something close to religion is described. Janice is talking about how humans look into the sky for danger because this is where danger comes from every single time. We think that's where danger comes from. And she continues, no matter how hard humans try thinking otherwise, they still think like Greeks. For the Greeks, when you looked ahead, all you saw was the past. It was like the past was the future. It never occurred to anyone that they ought to be looking at their own daughters, which is a very interesting plea for humanity. But, you know, even though there is, of course, that parable that Janice actually mentions, the Rate of the Beads, and even though there's a lot of, I suppose, spirituality in writing horse stories at one point in this book, my question is why religion itself, in I guess any sense, wasn't really explored in this book. Because clearly there's this great spiritual need that all of your beings in this book have, you know?
Well, I felt like I had hit the subject of religion, to say head on is maybe overstating it, but I was very preoccupied with that subject specifically in The Thin Place, the book I wrote before Duplex.
Yes. And you were religioned out.
It's of the utmost importance to me when you consider what it means to either have a soul or not have a soul.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that in this book, the subject of religion was as much a subject I was going to avoid as naming names, specifics of place, all the things I had done in the former book. I wanted to apply my imagination to some of these same questions I have about what does it mean to have a soul or not have a soul, but leave the world of religion out of it.
Yeah. So you wanted to approach the notion of spirituality in a more secular approach this time.
Yeah.
Is this also one of the appeals of the... Was this also one of the appeals of the robots as well? Because typically the tech crowd, well, you're not really going to find a lot of religion there. They're going to go ahead and point to to Richard Dawkins or someone.
Right.
And they're going to say, well, the actual technology itself, this is the spirituality. This is our new world. And then we get into arguments of singularity and all that. But nevertheless, is that one of the appeals as well for this?
Yeah, I think so. And now I'm trying to remember. This is going to be so annoying to me
no
that
worries.
I cannot remember the name of this woman who I heard just utterly by coincidence when I was traveling with my husband this summer in Canada. And just happened to turn on the radio just as this woman who teaches at a university in Minnesota and is in the religion and robot department. Now I'm just...
God, this rings a bell. Yeah.
And she was talking about the book that she has just written, which investigates the subject of the soul in the machine. And
sort of like a Kurzweilian type of thing, yeah.
And could it be that a robot could be made that could then possess something like what we would call a soul?
I've seen a video clip of this woman, and I'm blanking on her name, too. I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I would like to mention her name because I admired what she said, and I ordered her book, and I even wrote her a fan letter.
It shall be Googled, it shall be added to the show notes, and it shall be mentioned in the introduction. How about that?
Thank you. That would be really great.
And it shall be emailed to you when we're done with this after we've had a chance to Google it.
Because I felt like she was thinking in a different way about some of the very things that I was thinking about when I wrote the book. And... Well, really, could a robot, in fact, because of behaviors, could it come to approximate having something like a soul? What would that even mean? And I think I am in agreement with this nameless woman who wrote the book, that it would. That's not what you would get. You wouldn't get a soul. A soul is something different.
Yeah.
And I do believe that that is the case. So I don't believe that there isn't such a thing that goes beyond our experience that is immaterial. I'm a pretty firm believer in the immaterial as well as the material world.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of such deep, profound questions, I have to ask you about the dachshunds that appear in your book. You know, this of course, is the most deeply symbolic aspect, I think, of Duplex and your previous books, because dachshunds have appeared in a number of your books. And I'm wondering, you were alluding while we were setting up to being a dog lover and a dog walker. We were talking about an internecine battle in your hood. But I was curious about the dachshunds in specific. The dachshunds are a very specific and very wonderfully temperamental breed. Gary Steingart tweets about his dachshund. Chekhov was very much into dachshunds.
Nabokov
as well.
He had dachshunds.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I'm wondering if the appeal is kind of the fusion of the personal and the literary, or what?
Well, it just so happened that when I was a little girl and wanted a dog, my parents thought, let's get a dachshund.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
I was 5 years old, so I wasn't really allowed to weigh in on this.
Yeah.
But, and the reasons for the dachshund, you know, some of them had to do with the charm of the appearance of the breed. It was going to definitely be a red, short-haired dachshund because my mother didn't want a dog that shed big tufts of hair.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with dachshunds.
Yeah.
And they were a hugely important part of my childhood and the life in our house, in a household that was in many ways fairly dysfunctional.
Yes.
My parents, one really good thing they did was to teach my sister and me how to, you know, love animals.
Yeah.
They loved the animals, and we talked to them. We understood that they were doing essentially the equivalent of talking back to us. It was a big part of my life. Then to find out that some of my most admired writers also had dachshunds.
Yeah.
Well, Chekhov and Nabokov.
Yes.
Specifically, it was just, you know, icing on the cake.
You start doing a babushka dance as well once
yeah.
you're done.
And then finally, in terms of Duplex,
yes.
I thought a dachshund, of all dogs, it seemed like the most appropriate, especially the short-haired variety, the most appropriate dog in a book that has robots.
Yeah.
Not that they seem to me robotic, but they just seem sort of perfectly on the edge of belonging to this world and looking like they maybe came from somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a dachshund now?
I don't.
You don't?
No.
What was the last pet dachshund you had?
Oh, it was when I was growing up in Philadelphia.
Is that experience recent enough to write a plausible novel about dachshunds?
I think so.
Okay.
And, I mean, I would actually like to get a dachshund. This has been a bone of contention with me.
I see.
My husband, since I have been living away from my parents,
yeah.
The very first dog I got as an adult was an Alaskan Malamute. And those dogs, there's some of them populating the world of the thin place.
Yeah.
And that is the dog I've had ever since I was 20 years old, Alaskan Malamutes.
Yeah.
And I have one now.
Well, that's good for you to choose the Malamute over the infamous Bello breed, because the Malamutes don't get nearly as much credit for it. I'm sorry.
But I would like to have a dachshund and a Malamute, and
yeah.
My husband is not as enthusiastic about that idea.
Yeah.
So, but
well, while we're on the subjects of literary animal connections, I'm wondering if the horse storytelling was a way to impugn Jane Smiley in any sense.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, because I was thinking, like, if it, I could, I was almost reading this as a possibly a sort of vague satire of Smiley. I don't know, but we can get the official word here from you.
No. That was kind of autobiographical.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I do think probably true to the experience of many girls,
yeah.
That love of horses often spills out into the crafting of impossibly tedious stories about horses. The little portion of the novel that is included in my novel is as close as I could come to replicating, you know, my own prose style when I was, you know, 8 years old writing a book about a horse.
One of the things that really impressed me formalistically about your book is the fact that you took the Yellow Bear chapter out of a significant objects entry. Now, for those who don't know what significant objects is, it's the situation where there's an object, you're allowed to bid on it, a writer writes a story around it, and this affects the bidding. What's amazing, and this, to my knowledge, is the first time this is done, is that this ended up in your novel. And I'm wondering, you know, did this kind of allow for an additional trigger? Because the Yellow Bear, there's this discussion of whether it's like a genuine baby or a toy. I'm wondering how little requests like this to do something fed their way so explicitly in your novel. I've never heard of anybody, especially, and I love significant objects. In fact, they asked me to do one time, and someone did a bobblehead video inspired by my entry. It was amazing. But I'm wondering,
that's,
you know,
great.
I'm wondering, you know, this notion of explicit creativity like this. Do you need like cues like this, or are you just an unapologetic magpie here?
Well, that was definitely a magpie impulse.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I was asked to participate in the Significant Objects project at a point where I was already involved in writing the novel.
Yes.
And so you get to select your object.
Yes.
From among four, I think you have a choice. And I saw that bear.
Yeah.
And I knew that I wanted to write about it. And I also knew that whatever I wrote was in some way going to, I didn't know if it specifically was going to end up word for word in the novel, but the bear looked to me like it belonged in the book I was writing.
Yeah.
And so that was partly why I was attracted to it, and why what I wrote felt to me much more interesting to me than, you know, any sort of little project somebody might ask you to participate in, and your whole heart and soul may not be involved in it.
Did that yellow bear trigger the sorcerer?
The sorcerer, I had the sorcerer, okay. But definitely the yellow bear helped inform my sense of the sorcerer. That it was a big deal writing that, and it really did make a difference in the writing of the book.
That's really amazing. Well, also I think you also had the liberal mind to actually go ahead and say, well, here's an opportunity, here's a way for all of my fiction to kind of riff off each other rather than just compartmentalize it and all that too. That's fascinating. I actually have to ask you about some of the sexuality in this book. It involves this violent effort to quite literally reach inside and take a part of the girls. You know, Janice's parable, it was like having the smallest parts of your body, like the corpuscles and peptides and nuclei and follicles, rip loose from one another, every single one of them. And that to me is amazing, that intimacy in this world would involve just taking very small bits of people. I guess you could, you know, I guess the cynic could probably say that, well, that's what all intimacy is. But I'm wondering why that notion of pilfering space became so indelibly associated with the intimacy in this particular world.
Well, partly in terms of the Reign of Beebs.
Yeah.
Janice is often purveying information that is of specific interest to girls as they're sort of developing as young women. And so on one level, her that grotesque image of being torn apart by the act of intercourse, although it is with robots, certainly seemed familiar to me with the sense you get growing up and hearing stories about what sex is before you really understand what's being described to you, and you think, oh my God, that's not a very good idea. So there was, I wanted some of that in all of Janice's stories, to be that level of appalling horror that just growing up involves, or being a human being.
Well, it's also an interesting way to provide a counterpoint to something we've been seeing as robots have been developing and becoming more sophisticated, the idea of, well, here's the sexual stud who can satisfy every woman or every man or whatever.
Right.
And it's a nice way of saying, well, this fantasy is going to involve violence. It's going to, it's not going to be as clean as you're making it out to be, in no double entendre sense of the word.
Right, right. Yeah. Even though you would think that a robot would be about as clean as it
gets. Yes, exactly.
And, you know, and then the whole issue of space, which was of great interest to me in this book, since I think I've often reflected on the fluidity of time and the way, you know, our any linear sense of time is a fair, it's a fraud.
Yes.
I've thought about that a lot. I have not so much thought so specifically about how a tiny space like one suburban street could in fact contain the whole universe.
Yeah.
And so in that way, having something broken down into its smallest component parts was on my mind a lot while I was writing the book.
There was one review that made a very interesting observation that I want to talk with you about. It's by Elisa Solario. She pointed out that you define your women and your girls in this book extremely interestingly. She pointed out they don't fall into roles of artists, housewives, revolutionaries, but are defined by how they control the mechanisms between their past, their present, and their future selves. Solario notes, real women aren't immune to time. That's the one boundary they can't break. You have moments in this book where Miss Vix walks along a wall, unable to see the other side, and a moment where Janice says the ocean isn't infinite when she confronts this tsunami-like wave. And I'm wondering how much of Duplex was also written with this idea of gender roles being defined more by time than anything else.
I in a way, that might be the very first, not thought, but deep interior wish I had for the book.
Yes.
Because I did know I wanted an entire lifetime to be included in this book.
Yes.
But I also wanted that sense of how constricting it is, but also how kind of infinite it is at simultaneously, duplexly.
Yes. Oh, actually, I wanted to ask you, there's the triangle-shaped sideburns of the Rockets, and I'm wondering if they were mentioning, I mean, I thought Charlie Sheen in Major League, that ridiculous thing, I wonder if that was a sly reference to that.
It wasn't, but, you know, you wouldn't know, I'm a baseball fan.
I figured, yeah.
And I have noticed the different sorts of ways baseball players contrive, particularly among members of a team, to do something that they will then have in common the fact that they are wearing goatees or that they're doing something strange with their sideburns.
Yes.
So it was that in particular, though I bet there was a residual memory of Charlie Sheen that leaked out as I wrote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm also wondering, because you do have the trading cards in this, they're not explicitly defined as baseball. It's almost as if, well, in another universe, they would be baseball trading cards, but in this universe, baseball can't even be mentioned. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
And those cards are, they are the cards we had as girls.
Yes.
That were, you know, dogs, and, you know, kittens and puppies and scenes and flowers. When the boys had their baseball cards that they would...
Garbage Pail Kids, movie trading cards.
Right, right.
There were all sorts of weird cards. There was like... there were some Cabbage Patch Kids trading cards.
Oh.
I remember those.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
I hated those Cabbage Patch dolls.
Which is why I love the Garbage Pail Kids ones. Well, I mean, but that's interesting. And then, of course, you know, there's Magic the Gathering, I guess. Did you do a lot of trading cards? Did you collect a lot of them growing up?
Just the kinds of cards and the trading I describe in the book when I was a pretty little girl on the street, and we would have these cards in cigar boxes, and there would be endless negotiation, trading, trying to get the white horse that went along with the black horse for a pair. It was much less, product-oriented than what the boys were doing, because they were getting their cards out of bubblegum packs.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we were just stealing them from the parents' playing cards decks.
Well, there was a little bit. I can assure you there was theft where I grew up, because we couldn't afford the gum packs and all that. This leads me to ask, what section of Duplex was the most difficult for you to negotiate or write about? Did the very shifting limits of your universe give you a headache as a novelist? Was there any part in specific?
No, that part, I think, because, again, not to try to make it sound simpler than it was, but it's so much reflected the way I live my life and experience the world, that I didn't have to plan that, and it didn't give me headaches. What gave me a headache was figuring out that this was the book I wanted to write. That was the hard part. And it took a while. After I finished the last book, I had a number of false starts. And every false start, now this is going to be an exaggeration, but, you know, I'm a novelist. I can lie
The hyperbole is allowed on this program.
Good, good. So, but pretty much every false start, I would think, yes, this is it. I've got my hands on what I want to be doing. And I would get 17 pages and I would think, this is so boring. And that happened time after time. Every time there was some little piece of what I was doing that I realized finally was quite fascinating to me, the whole of it never was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I thought I was going to lose my mind trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do. And I was lucky enough to be at the Ligurian Study Center in Italy, knowing perfectly well that everybody else was sitting in their rooms writing away, happy as can be. And I thought, I can't even go to lunch. It's too embarrassing. They're all going to be so excited. And I remembered the advice I gave and always give my students, which is, you know, do something different. Turn your attention in a different direction. And I had been asked to write a version of a fairy tale.
Yeah.
Kate Bernheimer, for her wonderful book, had asked me if I would be willing to write a modern fairy tale, and I had sort of said, well, I don't know if I'm going to have time. I'm trying to write this novel, and I just thought, you know, write the goddamn fairy tale.
Yeah.
And I had brought with me the one I thought I might use, called Body Without Soul, in Italo Calvino's collection.
Yes.
And the minute I started to do that, it was, you know, like choirs of angels were singing, and I heard, and I wrote the very beginning of the book as it now exists.
Yeah.
And so that, the hardest part was getting to that place. And then once I was there, I think because I had struggled so hard to figure out which door I wanted to open, once I opened it, then it, not that it, you know, went without any effort, but that was the hard part.
What was the hesitation about opening that door?
That's a great question, because something clearly was preventing me from writing the book I ended up writing. And
the very limits of your world, maybe?
Yeah, that could be. I know I never want to write the same book over again.
Sure.
And I was so trying not to write another Thin Place. It was driving me in some really strange directions, and sort of too far, like really, really long sentences. Yeah. I don't know what I thought I was doing.
I mean, that leads me to wonder, I mean, how does language provide a path for you to, or even the encouragement to open that
door?
That
was it.
Yeah.
It was the language. It really was. It was writing, you know, the first sentences of what became the first sentences of the book, hearing the sound of that language and thinking, this is the world. This language is appropriate to the world I want to be in. Because you have to feel like you want to enter the world of a book and be there for a while, or there's no point in writing it.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I'm sure you've read a lot of books where the writer has been holding a gun to their head, making themselves stay someplace where they're so bored.
Yes. Or Kate Atkinson once described this situation in, I believe, the third Jackson Brody book, where she had these characters who were supposed to meet, and she kept writing and she kept writing, and they never actually met. And she's writing about one and writing about another, and then when they finally did meet, they never actually got along. And that's just kind of what happens sometimes. You may have a design for something to happen, but maybe it's not meant to happen. Maybe you're meant to sort of drive in a car and go the other way, and actually that might provide the most unexpected meaning about what you intended to do in the first place. Yeah.
Exactly. I love Kate Atkinson.
Oh, I love her too. Yeah, I love her too. I figured you did, being a mystery writer, mystery reader as well. Yeah.
But that is, if I had thought, I want to write a book that has some robots in it.
Yeah.
I know I would have resisted that. I mean, there was some way I had to trick myself into getting to the place that I was in the world I actually found fascinating and wanted to write about.
Okay. Well, that seems a great place to end. Catherine, this was a hell of a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I've had a great time.
I drink to remember, I smoke to forget, some things to be proud of, some stuff to regret. Gone down some dark alleys in my own head, but something's changing. Changing, changing. I go back to Clifton to see my old friends, the best people I could ever have met. Skin up a fat one, hide from the feds. And something's changing, changing, changing. So I kiss goodbye to